Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's guest speaker will be Sam McEwen, sports writer for the Omaha World Herald, who specializes in covering the University of Nebraska Cornhusker football program. As part of his talk, he'll break down the Huskers' first season in the Big Ten. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Some of Mr. McEwen's remarks may be dated by events which have taken place since this program was recorded. Here now to introduce the speaker is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
You do not have to read much of Sam McEwen's stuff or listen to him very long before you can see it. This guy knows football, a quote from fellow journalist Henry Cordes. Sam is the lead football writer for the Omaha World Herald, who has a sharp eye for detail and an analytical mind who knows the X's and O's as lead football writer. He is also introduced as the smartest guy on the show during his weekly appearances on an Omaha sports radio station. Today we'd like to introduce Sam McEwen.
You can see I can't hang up my jacket, so I'm truly a sports writer. I guess I've been brought here to talk about Nebraska football, and so I will try to keep on topic and talk a little bit about just where the program's at right now. Not only that, but also sort of the relationship that we have with fans and we have with the team. So I suppose I'll start with. Which is where the Nebraska football program is at this time. You know, this is a program that most people here know has been a traditional power for about 50 years now. Next week, Nebraska will be going to Wyoming, and that is the school from which Bob Devaney came from a long time ago, 1962 or 63. And since Devaney's arrival at that time, Nebraska's not only been sort of a football powerhouse, but a cultural one too. Since that time, Nebraska's been selling out its football games with fans, and it's also been a team that's been very successful on the field too. And so you're talking about a half century of built-up experience, and of course that's older than I am. I'm hardly that old. I'm only 33, so this predates my birth, and so obviously it's something that's been sort of ingrained in several generations of Nebraska. And so I think there's always a certain expectation level and a certain passion about the game. And it goes really beyond what happens for those 3 hours on Saturday afternoon. It extends to, our mornings and our weekends and during the week and the conversations that we have and the bonding that we have between, parents and children and brothers and sisters and extended families. People plan their weddings around it. People plan pretty much, their lives around those 11 or 12 Saturdays in the fall. And I think that's a pretty cool phenomenon. And that culture informs the expectation that's put on the team today. And so I start with that more because a lot of people overlook that and don't necessarily think about it or consider it. And I think it's an extremely important aspect to even the performance of the team. There's an expectation level that comes from the fans it's been born from something that happened a half century ago. And so I think every single day when we go down there as reporters, we have, I think, to a certain extent, a responsibility to at least carry that culture with us. Whether or not it shows up in all of our stories, I doubt it. But I think we're aware of it, and I think we're aware of that expectation. And I think sometimes people who come in from the outside, i.e. coaches who may not have grown up with it, are a little bewildered by it. I think they're a little bit surprised. I certainly think with this current coaching staff, as good as it is with X's and O's, has been taken by surprise to a certain extent by the level of adoration, the level of scrutiny, the level of interest that there is in the football program. And so it creates a kind of tension, not only between the journalist and the team, but the fan and the journalist, because we're trying to communicate through that tension, and in the process, I mean, there's going to be hiccups, and so I think that's all part of the story. No matter how the team does on the field, I think that cultural aspect is a crucial element of what we do. And it's part of why, you know, the World Herald employs so many people to cover Nebraska football. On Saturdays when we go up to Memorial Stadium, there's seven or eight of us standing there, you know, and there's a reason for that. And it's not simply because, you know, we like being there. I mean, we certainly enjoy covering the games, but it's more about the responsibility that we know that we have. And so as a result, I think, you know, what's happened since the retirement of Tom Osborne, which happened in late 1997, this program's been on an interesting journey since then. And I think most people could recount major milestones, pratfalls along the way. But I think since that time, you're talking about 15 years that have passed. And Nebraska's program sort of went into a slow apathetic decline after his retirement, something that wasn't clearly evident right away, but eventually became clear to a lot of different people. And then it went through tumultuous change over the course of really 3 years, 2004 through 2007. And then there was a kind of homecoming, right, with the athletic director suddenly becoming the guy that retired a decade before in Tom Osborne, and him bringing back someone into the fold that Frank Solich had tabbed in 2003 to be his defensive coordinator, Bo Pelini. And since then, I think there's been sort of a relief among Nebraska fans, a sort of happiness that there seems to be sort of a return to this thing that's mythically called the Nebraska way. And as a result, we're in year four now of the Bo Pelini era, and I think fans are sort of torn a little bit. I think they haven't seen necessarily the progress that they had hoped to see in some areas, but in other things they've seen incredible progress. And of course, I think most of them are still on board with a guy like Pelini, who has enough ties to the old establishment of Osborne and Solich and so forth to have, I suppose, the ear of the fans on many circumstances. Bo Pelini is an interesting man. I think he's a complex guy. Overall, I know that he has a certain reputation with how he feels about us, and I suppose we have a certain reputation in certain circumstances about how we feel about him. But the reality is, he's a complex guy. He's a person who I think is very cerebral in some ways. If you look at his background, you're looking at somebody who has been successful his entire life, and I think that that's an important aspect of his character and his personality. You're talking about somebody who came from Youngstown, Ohio, and was a captain at Ohio State University as a football player. And I don't know that there's really too many higher honors that a kid from Youngstown, Ohio could aspire to than to be an academic all Big Ten kid and a captain for the Ohio State football team. 3 or 4 years removed from playing at Ohio State, he then became a part of a Super Bowl winning team with the San Francisco 49ers as a quality control guy. And then he proceeded to learn under some of the finest defensive minds from that point forward, including Pete Carroll and George Seifert and Monty Kiffin and others. And so this is a guy that's really been on a meteoric rise from the minute that he got out of high school. He's been progressing forward really toward this moment. He's still a really young guy. He's only about, I'm going to say, 10 to 11 years older than me. As the young kid in my family, I have brothers who are 43 and 46. So I'm kind of used to people in that age range. So a guy like Bo Pelini is somewhat relatable to me because I've got brothers that age, and I've got one that I think probably has a personality somewhat similar to Bo. And so, you know, this is a person who I think really it gnaws away at him when they don't do what he hopes they'll do. I think failure eats at people that are surprised by it. And I think because of his sort of meteoric rise in coaching, I think failure is something that's really hard for him to deal with, and it gnaws at him, as I think it gnaws at a lot of us. But there hasn't been a lot of time in his life where there was time to sort of look at things perhaps objectively and say, you know, the brakes didn't go my way. This is a guy that's really been on a roller coaster to the top. And if you go back to 2009, and there was 1 second left in the Big 12 championship, and I think a lot of people remember that game, and if that 1 second ticks off and they don't put that 1 second back on, you're talking about a coach who, by the time he was about 40 years old, had won a Big 12 championship and completely resurrected a program in the course of 2 years. And that would have been a pretty extraordinary achievement, and it would have been right in line with everything he had done prior to that moment. Unfortunately, they put that second back on. Texas made the field goal and Nebraska lost. And I think, although I don't think Nebraska's necessarily still in the morning of that game, it sort of inexorably has changed the direction of the program. I think a year later, we look at where Nebraska is now, and I think the expectation is still there. People still have memories of that game, of how brilliant the defensive plan was that day, and how they were able to stifle really one of the best college quarterbacks I've ever seen. But at the same time, there's this sense of feeling incomplete on the other side of the ball, and having held on too long to an old offensive coordinator who belonged really to a different era, to a different coach, and was really kept on in part because the athletic director, Tom Osborne, thought he was a good man and a guy full of integrity and could help Bo Pelini sort of transition into the second part of his career. Last year, 2010, I think was a season which most people thought that a rising tide would lift all boats. I think there was every intention at Nebraska to win a national championship last year. I thought Nebraska would be a one-loss team last year. I thought they'd go to the BCS. I thought they'd win the Big 12 championship. I think a lot of people did too. If you look at the talent that was on that team, it was extraordinary. It was really the combination of the best of both worlds. The recruiting acumen of Bill Callahan, which was about the only thing he did do well, with the coaching ability of Bo Pelini. And when you put those two things together, it should have been a pretty incredible mix. They had a lot of great players on that team, a lot of guys that got drafted in the NFL, a lot more guys that will be on NFL rosters for years to come. And the schedule was, in some ways, a dream. The one big game of the year against Texas was at home. So it really should have fallen in line. I think a lot of people expected maybe a one-loss or even a zero-loss season. And about 3 weeks before the season began, Bo Pelini was at a scrimmage, a Saturday scrimmage, and there was a kid named Taylor Martinez who busted off a huge run, several big runs against Nebraska's top defense, which at the time I'm sure he considered the best in the country. And it was at that moment that Bo Pelini made a pretty fateful decision. He was going to start a redshirt freshman, the first one ever at Nebraska, in Nebraska's first game. And that decision informed everything that happened last year. It was in some ways an impulsive decision, and in some ways it was a prescient decision. I think prior to that decision, he was planning on looking at Zach Lee as his starting quarterback. And, you know, Zach was a guy who was a senior leader. He had gained the respect of a number of the senior players on the offensive line and the wide receivers. I was always a guy that liked Zach Lee as a person. I thought he was a tougher kid than he was given credit for, and I thought he was a pretty good leader. But I think Pelini saw in Taylor Martinez somebody who could make big plays and had a kind of mental toughness that I think is hard for us to see, mostly because Taylor's not necessarily as eloquent as some other people might be. But he felt like Taylor had this sort of mental toughness, right? And so as a result, the offense changed incredibly 3 weeks before the season. It was one of those coaching decisions that was sort of fateful and a big gamble, but it was indicative of Pelini's career because he's a very confident guy. And that decision looked like a wonderful one for about five games. I mean, it looked like it was a brilliant coaching gambit. And then the Texas game came. And I think a lot of people remember that game and how things fell apart and things kind of collapsed. And they pulled Taylor at halftime, essentially, and they inserted the guy that had been sitting on the bench for a month, and it didn't really work out. And I think that game really sort of stuck an interesting sort of javelin in the heart of the program. I know with a lot of fans it was tough because of what had happened with the Big 12. I know that it was hard for a lot of different reasons. And I think as a result, the team really faltered down the stretch. They fell apart in some ways. I don't think that there was necessarily infighting among the team, but I don't think the chemistry was as good as it could have been. And so they lost 3 of 4. And the game that sort of serves as the rallying point, or I suppose the microcosm of last season, was at Texas A&M. And I'm pretty sure everybody here remembers that game really well. It was the kind of game where I actually wasn't there, but it's the kind of game that was actually better to see on TV because it was a game that was indicative of how television has changed the way we look at college football. And the camera that was posed on Bo Pelini for 3.5 hours, and what it captured and what it showed and what it said about Nebraska's program, I think really sunk in with a lot of Nebraska fans. I don't know that it changed their minds on the program or the coach, but I think it gave them a bit of a pause. And that game sort of served as an example of some of the things that happened in Nebraska last year: disorganization, lack of communication, anger, infighting among teammates, lack of control in terms of personal fouls, et cetera, gaining a bad reputation, which contributed to some of the penalties that Nebraska received in that game that were, in my opinion, pretty bogus. All of those things sort of coalesced into like a 3.5-hour period, and it And it's a game where when you watch it again on TV, I know fans and family members, it just gives me this weird sort of sick feeling, you know, like it was just one of those moments. And so the team this year, I think, in some ways is still a bit locked in that mode. The team that I've seen through the first two games sort of lacks the swagger and the fire and the edge that you saw prior to that Texas A&M game. And I don't know if it's a residual issue from the Texas A&M game or if it's something else. But I don't quite see the same kind of coach. I don't quite see the same kind of team. I think there's, interestingly enough, the person who seems to have grown the most is the quarterback. I think he's grown probably more than some of his teammates have in terms of emotional maturity and mental toughness. He seems to be doing better in those areas than he ever did last year, and I think that's a positive thing for Nebraska fans. But on the flip side of the coin, I think some of the other players are still in that sort of waiting mode, and we may see them break loose of it this weekend against Washington, because I know they want to beat Washington pretty badly after what happened in the Holiday Bowl. So, but I still see this team that's sort of in this tension. And, you know, I know that I'm pretty analytical in the way that I write and that I write a lot about X's and O's and get into details with recruiting and things like that. But ultimately, when I look at the team, I look at this large sort of macro storyline. I say, what is the story? And I think this team is still in that tension of who are we? You know, what kind of team are we going to be? When we tried to be that certain team last year, it backfired on us. Who are we going to be now that we're in the Big Ten? We don't know anything about the Big Ten. And even though they say they know, they don't really know. We don't really know anything about the Big Ten. So what kind of teams are those going to be? And so who are we going to be in response to the teams that those are? And so there's this tension, this tension of identity, you know. And even though I cover football, I still think that there's, you know, sort of the classic storylines of, you know, man versus other, man versus wild, or man versus man. And I think that's there too. The question of this team is, who are they? What's the identity of it? And more importantly, what is the trajectory of the head coach? A person who has really, other than his playing days at Ohio State, which he really doesn't talk about very much, hasn't really experienced a whole lot of setbacks or failure. This is a guy who's always been considered one of the smartest people in the room, a great motivator, and a guy whose players love him. And when you're surrounded by that much success for most of your professional career, what happens when things don't go your way, and how do you respond, and how do you grow? And so I see that tension playing out this year, and I'm really curious and excited to see how the 2011 season unfolds, given all of these teams that Nebraska's never played, and given all these teams that I've really never paid that much attention to. I have a lot of extended family in Iowa, and so I've always felt like I was sort of a mini Hawkeyes expert, because all of my extended family likes Iowa, but I don't know that much about the Big Ten. I'm learning just like everybody else is. And I'm learning about the cultures, and I'm learning about, you know, the teams and the coaches and the styles and all the things that go in to making a successful football program that ultimately forms a chunk of this state's identity, or any state's identity. I spent some time in Wisconsin this summer talking to their coaching staff, talking to Barry Alvarez, who's the athletic director there, talking to some fans, and I was struck by, you know, the cultural identity that the state of Wisconsin gets from football. And it's sort of a split identity, mind you. I mean, they have some of it from Green Bay, which I think is somewhat similar to Nebraska football. And then I think they have some of it from Wisconsin too. So they've forged their football identity really on the last 60 years of the NFL with Vince Lombardi and the Green Bay Packers, and then the last 20 years or so of Wisconsin football. And so when you travel around, you find that identities are a little bit different where you go, but they're still there, you know. They're still an important part of culture, and people really care about the team. And I know that people in Wisconsin, for example, are really hyped up for this Nebraska game. They had these buttons out on the table to beat all the teams, and the beat Nebraska button was empty like 5 times. So people were really fired up for that game. I think they're really excited, because they understand that the program that Barry Alvarez built was built on the same principles that Bob Devaney used to build Nebraska. And so what Wisconsin's kind of going through right now is kind of what Nebraska was going through in the mid-70s. You know, when Tom Osborne took over, they have a coach who took over for Barry Alvarez, who was also handpicked, and they're kind of going through that phase now where they're trying to see, is this the guy? Is this an Osborne? You know, Osborne, I think, had to go through that testing period too of 6 to 8 years, where I think people were, again, I wasn't alive, but I'm told that people were, you know, questioning whether he was a worthy successor to Bob Devaney. And I think Brett Bielema, the Wisconsin coach, who is a huge man, by the way, a giant guy. He's like 6'5", just huge. His head's like the size of my face. His hand, I should say. And, you know, I think they're going through the same questions with him. Is he the guy that's going to carry on the legacy that Barry Alvarez started? Because one thing to remember, and I've learned this about the Big Ten here in the last 6 months, winning a Rose Bowl in the Big Ten, it's not quite like winning a national championship, but it's darn close. So Barry Alvarez won 3 of those. And that's a big deal in the Big Ten to win one of those. I don't know if it's because of the cultural history or because, you know, it's the Rose Bowl, the name of it. But it's a big, big deal. And so, like, you talk to people about, you know, teams in the Big Ten, and they'll say, well, I remember the 92 Michigan team, they won the Rose Bowl. Or I remember the 99 Wisconsin team, they won the Rose Bowl. The 2000 Purdue team went to the Rose Bowl. It's almost like a national championship. I mean, it's a really big deal, you know. And I was talking to Kirk Ferentz over the summer, the Iowa football coach. They've had a lot of success under Kirk Ferentz, but he's never been to a Rose Bowl. And in 2002, they went 11-1 in the regular season. And they just presumed they were going to the Rose Bowl because, right, Ohio State was going to the national championship game to play Miami. And the Orange Bowl had the choice first. And the Orange Bowl picked Iowa. And Ferentz was telling me how disappointing that was. He's like, I couldn't believe it that they picked us. We didn't want that at all. And the Orange Bowl was real clever because they also picked USC. So they kind of had their own little Rose Bowl because Washington State had technically won the Pac-10 that year in a tiebreaker with USC. And so the Rose Bowl was stuck with Oklahoma playing Washington State that year. But after that, after the Orange Bowl picked Iowa for that game, the Rose Bowl went back to the BCS and put like a stipulation in that says the Big Ten champion, if they don't go to play in the national championship, they got to go to the Rose Bowl. So it just gives you a sense of how important that game is. It's a big deal. It's a really, really big deal. And again, it's not quite like the national championship, but it's close. And so Barry Alvarez has achieved a kind of status in Wisconsin that Bob Devaney had here. I mean, there's a statue of him out front. There's a statue of the athletic director there, you know, and under a statue says 3 Rose Bowls. That's the first thing. And that's like saying 3 national championships in the state of Wisconsin. So Wisconsin's kind of going through right now what Nebraska went through in the 70s. Nebraska's going through this completely different change, moving conferences, an experience that really they haven't gone through for a really long time. I couldn't exactly tell you when they moved from the Missouri Valley to the Big 8 or the Big 6 or whatever it was, but certainly it was nothing as cataclysmic as what they're going through now. They're facing all new teams. That means a lot more work in the film room. That means a lot more work in terms of adjustments during the game. And so it's really a trial and error kind of thing. And the standard, the bar's kind of been set high because when Penn State went into the Big Ten, they kind of ran the table like right away. And that was the Penn State team that didn't win the national title in 94 when Nebraska did. So Penn State kind of went in and they thought they were pretty hot stuff, which they were that year. But after that, the Big Ten really, you know, really took a chunk out of Penn State. Penn State hasn't really been the same program since they moved to the league. They've had some success. I think they've been to 1 Rose Bowl since 94, which was a couple of years ago. But outside of that, they've had a hard time. So it's not easy to win in the Big Ten. Okay, it's easy to beat 1 Big Ten team in the state of Florida on January 1st after you've had a month to prepare. It's not easy to win the Big Ten. There was TCU's head coach Gary Patterson said last year before the Rose Bowl, if I had to play Wisconsin 1 week after the season, there's no way we would have won because Wisconsin was way too physical, would have worn TCU out, it would have been a blowout. Nebraska is not necessarily built like TCU, don't get me wrong. Nebraska has bigger guys than that. But Nebraska is going to be facing a pounding every week in that league, a physical beating. you know, for 1 week it'll be Wisconsin, 1 week it'll be Ohio State, the next week it'll be Michigan State. You can say whatever you want about these teams, but they're big teams and they're physical and they pound on you. It's like a slower version of the SEC. The SEC and the Big Ten are actually not that far apart, except for one thing: they have speed in the SEC, and the players are better schooled because they can play spring football. But the leagues are not that different. The Big Ten and the Big 12 are different because the Big 12 is sort of this, I don't know if it's even going to survive, but the Big 12 is sort of this grassroots conference that's been informed by high school coaches the last 10 years. The spread offenses have come from the Texas high schools. Art Briles was a high school coach, right? Mike Leach was a high school guy. He's not at Texas Tech anymore, but the point remains the same. A lot of these, it's sort of a grassroots organization that's coming up. And so it's more like basketball on grass, to be perfectly frank. The Big Ten is more traditional, yeah, aside from Northwestern, which also runs kind of a spread zone offense. So they're going to get pounded every week physically. And Nebraska's really struggled with injuries over the last 2-3 years. So I'm really intrigued to see how they handle from week to week the injury issue, how they get guys back, how they stay healthy, how they put people on the field. I think most of you know by now, if you read the World Herald this morning, there's a chance Nebraska will start 2 walk-ons on the offensive line this weekend. They're missing their corner, Alfonso Dennard. I don't know if he's going to play this weekend or not, but they really miss him. He's the best player on Nebraska's defense, in my opinion, perhaps by a wide margin. And they really miss him. And so when you get in conference play, if he's still hurt or he's not 100%, how does that change how you play teams that are really physical and downhill? So Nebraska has a lot of challenges ahead of it. I think when the schedule came out last year, the Big Ten schedule, I think a lot of Nebraska fans said, whoa, this is intense. They're going to beat us up. Then the Big Ten struggled through the conference season. I'm sure everybody remembers this. Iowa went in the tank. They were supposed to be way better than they were. They went in the tank a little bit. Ohio State was very good, but then they lost their 5 players, including Terrell Pryor, who was sort of their rock star. Michigan went in the tank and fired its coach. Wisconsin was good, but Michigan State got blown out in the bowl game. Wisconsin lost its bowl game. And so I think over the spring and the summer, Nebraska fans were a lot more optimistic, and they said, well, wait a minute. The Big Ten was the same old Big Ten in December and January, so Nebraska's going to win the league. And that's what all the preseason prognostications bore out, too. Nebraska's going to win its division. They're going to win the Big Ten the first year, inaugural year. It'll be easy. You know, business as usual, so on and so forth. And I'm just intrigued to see if that bears out. Part of me would be surprised if it does, because I think it's harder to win in a league, to win a league, than to play one team from a league, which is what the SEC always does. And the SEC never plays, you know, in Michigan in November. So, you know, I'm curious to see how Nebraska handles that. I guess we could talk about the offense and the defense a little bit. Okay. I guess we can talk a little bit about what's gone on just between Nebraska's offense and defense for the first couple of games. I think most people know that Nebraska's quarterback is Taylor Martinez. He's a kid that has been through more than most quarterbacks have been through in their first 18 months as a starter. I think he's been in some ways criticized unfairly, not only by fans but by the press, not necessarily by me, but by other people. I think he comes from not the easiest background in the world, and I think he was trained to be one kind of player, and then late in his high school career he decided he wanted to be a quarterback, and he gave that a shot. And he's still learning. He's still learning how to do it. I think he's still learning how to be a leader. I don't know that the coaches always did him any favors last year in the way that they allowed him to handle the media, which was not very well at all. I remember a really bizarre image in after the Texas game where Bo Pelini's standing where I'm standing right here, and then probably where that second tray is right over there, Taylor was standing, listening to the whole thing, but he wasn't going to talk to us. He was just going to stand there and listen. And it was a really strange moment because people were asking Bo about pulling Taylor from the game, and Taylor and his dad are standing there, and it's just a really strange image. And those kind of things happened too much last year. And I think, again, I'm not the kind to blame a 19-year-old kid for that. I'd probably go more on the coaching side of it. But he's grown as a player. He's really not ever going to change in terms of his mechanics. He's always going to be a guy who's fast, who takes unnecessary hits, who's going to fumble the ball sometimes, and who has a funny throwing motion. And that's just the reality of who he is. He makes a lot of huge plays. As he gets older, I think he'll get smarter with the ball, decision-making, leadership things, and so you'll see a growth there. But at the end of the day, you know, he is who he is. And Nebraska fans probably should get used to him. Bo Pelini is staunchly in his corner. I know a lot of people felt like after Bo sort of chewed him out in the Texas A&M game that there was a rift between them. All I would say is I don't think anything could be further from the truth. The head coach and the defensive coordinator who found him, Carl Pelini, are probably more in Martinez's corner than anybody. Now that Tim Beck is the offensive coordinator, he's part of that group too. So I don't think there's any question on the team and among the coaches who the starter should be. I know the fans argue about it a lot, and radio hosts, and even we do, but I don't think there's any question about that. The offensive line has struggled for several years. Some people would say that's because they were of two minds up until this year. Some plays they were asked to drive guys back, and other plays they were asked to influence people from side to side. So those aren't easy things to do for one guy. Different things are asked of different people. And so I think the offensive line now is being asked simply to come off the ball and to drive people backward and to block the defensive linemen first and then block those guys into the linebackers. One reason I think you've seen linebackers running free in the first couple of games is because I think the line has taken that edict a little too seriously. You know, you actually have to chip off and block the linebackers, but that hasn't happened as much as they had hoped. One of the reasons I think you see Spencer Long, who is a walk-on at right guard, and Sung-Hoon Choi, whom I think we'll learn a lot more over the next couple of weeks, will probably be the starter at left guard because they're strong kids. They really are strong in the weight room, and they're tough, and they'll come off the line, and they'll knock somebody back. They may not be as athletic as some of Nebraska's other linemen, and they certainly aren't big-name recruits, but they will do one thing well. And I think at times Nebraska, under Sean Watson, tried to do seven things okay and not one thing really well. And so I think what Nebraska's trying to do is conform its offense to an identity where they do one thing well, and that is run the ball straightforward, power. So they're trying to get to that point. A lot of people say, well, these walk-ons must mean that they're getting farther away from having a good offensive line. I'm not sure that's true. I think it actually could be the opposite. They might be getting closer to it. Because I think now they're finally starting to say, we're going to put people out on the field whom we know can do what we want them to do. And we're going to stop waiting for the great athletes to get to do it. The wide receivers are young but talented. The best personalities on the team are generally wide receivers. They all have this mentality of basketball players, by the way, these days. They all think they're going up for a dunk when they go up for a jump ball. But they're great guys. People will get to like them a lot. Their leader is Brandon Kinney. He's had a rough couple of weeks, but I like Brandon. Brandon's a good leader. He's a smart kid. He's mature for his age. He has his own son. His son's around quite a bit, after games, before games, things like that. He's a good dad, and that's actually encouraging to see. You know, Brandon does a good job with that. Some of the younger receivers, Kenny Bell Jr., you're going to learn a lot more about him over the next 4 years. He's a really interesting interview. He's a really fascinating kid, and I think you'll learn more about him, and he's really smart. Jamal Turner's an electric football player, very confident. Another kid with an incredible story, which I think you'll be reading about that in the World Herald in weeks to come. I think we're going to have a really good story on Jamal. He's gone through a lot in his young 18 years, and he's weathered a lot. And he's a tough kid and a good athlete, and very intelligent guy. I like where Nebraska's wide receiving core will be in future years. I think they're going to struggle at times this year just because they're doing it for the first time. And they're getting out there for the first time and trying to make the mistakes for the first time. Even though Brandon is there, you know, a lot of the other guys are younger. The running backs are led by Rex Burkhead, who I like to call Swiss Army Rex. He can pretty much do a lot of different things. He's really talented. He's really coordinated, if that makes any sense. Rex is the kind of guy that can do that, you know, like a hacky sack. Rex can do that for ages. He's gifted at everything he does. He's just very, very coordinated kid. And some people are just good at everything, and that's kind of Rex. I don't know that he's necessarily the caliber of athlete that Amir Abdullah is, but he's good at everything, and he's smart, and he works hard. And he has more personality than maybe his interviews would suggest. He's always very, very, you know, sort of deferential in his interviews, but Rex is a good leader, and he's actually a little bit tougher than people might think. So Rex is their lead guy. Amir Abdullah is a kid that Nebraska recruited late in the process, and I think everybody saw what he could do, and he's a fascinating football player. Tomorrow, one of our columnists, Dirk Chatelain, will be writing about Amir, and I think you're going to want to read it because it's really good. Amir's story is excellent. On the defensive side, I think most people know the defensive line, Jared Crick. The linebacker position, Levante David is an amazing player. I think he still makes too many mistakes for the coach's likings, probably for his likings. A couple of the biggest plays in the first two games were really actually busts he made. And so I think Levante still tries a little too hard to make every play on the field, and as a result, doesn't always make the plays he's supposed to make. But I think he's beginning to come around there, and he's beginning to trust some of the guys on the defense a little bit more. Levante has a tendency to want to try to go and make every play, and that'll get you out of position. In Nebraska's defense, you have to be very, very sound before you're aggressive. They call it slow to go, or a no before you go. They want you to understand where the play is going before you react to it. And the whole idea behind Bo Pelini's defense, a lot of defenses want to force you inward. Bo's defense is different. He wants to force you toward the sidelines. He wants to eliminate you going north-south, and he wants you to go east-west because he believes you can't run around the guys that he puts out on the perimeter. That's borne out to be true against Missouri, against other teams. He wants to stretch people this way and not allow them to go this way. So he's big on bouncing plays to the outside, and he uses a thing called lever and spill and things like that. But basically he wants running backs and quarterbacks and wide receivers to spill at all times, spill toward the sidelines, the invisible defender that always makes the tackle. He's very good at being able to look at things visually and conceptually and figure things out from a visual perspective. There's been times when Bo Pelini's went on the field and called a timeout, and he's told players, he'll point at them and say, you do this, you do this, you do this. They do it, and there's an interception. He's a very gifted visual learner. I mean, I'm not really quite like that, but I've heard players talk about it, how he's able to sort of see things in that way, in sort of a three-dimensional way. And so as a result, I think he's one of the finer defensive minds really in football. He's very specific. He's very detail-oriented. I think he keeps copious notes of what he's doing. He's more of an insular person than people might expect. Sometimes you'll go to practice and he'll just be sitting there by himself thinking. And you don't see a lot of coaches do that. You don't see a ton of coaches just sort of sitting off by themselves, just looking at things or taking a note. A lot of times they're more rah-rah, central hub, but he's not really like that. He's more off to himself. And I think that speaks to his cerebral nature. And sometimes I think that comes out. When plans don't go his way, I think he gets pretty frustrated. On the special teams, I think most people know that Brett Maher is Alex Henry's replacement. I think Brett will probably be as good of a punter as Alex. I don't know that he'll be as good of a place kicker, but we'll have to see. Kickers and punters, by the way, have gotten a lot better over the last 20 years. I don't care who they are. They've all gotten better because they're going to camps now. They're learning how to kick when they're 9 or 10 years old. Soccer has helped this process. Alex was a former soccer player. Kids are learning how to kick. And so when they get to college, the likelihood of them hitting a 47-yarder is a lot more likely than it used to be. I think most people remember Byron Bennett's kick in the 94 Orange Bowl when they lost to Florida State and how that was about 40 yards wide of the target. That stuff doesn't happen as much anymore. You have more foreign kids who are being recruited to come play college football. These kids are known and aware, so kicking and punting has become more of an art, and guys are better at it. But that's all I got.
Okay, we've got quite a few questions to get through. We'll try to get through as many as we possibly can. The first one is, who do you expect to be the next UNL AD and when?
I expect the next athletic director to be Paul Myers, honestly. Tom Chattel, one of our columnists, wrote about Paul a couple of months ago. Did you guys read that column by any chance? Yeah. Paul is an Omaha guy. He's a fundraiser. He's been with the athletic department a long time. I think he's shown that he has a level of integrity and enthusiasm. He's one of the guys that I think is one of the main reasons why the previous athletic director left or was let go. And I think Myers has quietly positioned himself for that role. Most people would say Trev Alberts, but here's one thing about Trev. Trev is a visionary. Whether you like his vision or you don't like his vision, Trev has a vision. Nebraska's vision is just about done. By the time a new athletic director takes over, there isn't going to be a whole lot for the next athletic director to do other than manage it. Tom Osborne's expanded the East Stadium. They've built the basketball arena. They've built baseball and softball practice facilities. There's not a lot for a visionary to do. I don't know what the next vision will be. They're in the Big Ten. That was the biggest vision move. Nebraska's not going to be developing its own network. The football facilities are great. There's just not a lot left to do from a facility standpoint or even a fundraising standpoint. They've pretty much got it in place. So I think the person that you need to come in after that is a Calvin Coolidge, so to speak, somebody who sort of keeps the peace. And I think Paul Myers is a really good guy to do that. Somebody who's a good manager of it, who knows the people there, who is a very good fundraiser and a very nice guy, and knows the business end of it really well. And I think he would do an excellent job. More importantly, I think he gets along real well with Bo. And I think in the future, if Nebraska wants to keep Bo Pelini here, then they need to have an athletic director in place that Bo knows and likes and get along with. And I don't know if he knows Trev that well. I mean, I'm sure he probably doesn't, because they probably haven't had a lot of opportunity to cross paths. So I think it'll be Paul Myers. Yeah.
Next question, if Ohio State calls, will Bo listen?
Yeah, I think so. In my opinion, he would be dumb not to. The better Nebraska does this year, the more likely Ohio State will call. I hope people realize that. If Nebraska goes 11-0 or runs the table in the Big Ten, Ohio State fans, alumni, and administrators will not be able to ignore that. The other thing that's very attractive about Bo Pelini is he runs a clean program. I'm not going to sit here and say that no player has ever committed a violation. I mean, because that's not true, because they had the textbook thing that they weren't even aware of. But the reality is Bo Pelini runs a clean program. His kids aren't getting arrested. They're going to class. He cares a lot about school, and he does a pretty good job. And so if you wanted to find somebody who could create a completely different tone on the behavioral standpoint, Pelini's track record is excellent. And I think Ohio State would be foolish not to look at him, provided Nebraska has a good season this year. If Nebraska goes 8-4, I think people will say, well, there's other names out there. The other thing is obviously that Ohio State could be very good this year, and they might just retain the guy they already have. I think the top target would be Urban Meyer. I think the second target would be John Gruden. But I think Bo's certainly in that mix.
How do you think Nebraska's recruiting will have to change in the future to compete in the Big Ten, or will it have to change?
Yeah, it'll change. In the past, over the last 3 to 4 years, they've been recruiting a lot in Texas. One reason they recruited in Texas, because Tim Beck had contacts there, and Mike Eckler had contacts there, and Sean Watson had contacts there. Beck was a former high school coach in the state of Texas. And in 08 and 09, some of the guys that got out of Texas weren't what I'd call first-tier prospects. They were probably second-tier guys. Or they were first-tier guys like Chris Williams, who tore his ACL. Chris Williams left the program about 2 months after he got to Nebraska. So anyway, Rex Burkhead was probably the only first-tier guy that Nebraska really recruited out of Texas those first 2 years. Some of the other guys they got, they weren't bad players, but they weren't the guys that Texas was going after. Since then, they've gotten a few guys that Texas is going after, notably Aaron Green, who is Andrew Green's younger brother, so there was sort of an in there. But I think the Texas recruiting strategy generally has not worked that well. I don't think that they've gotten a lot of great players out of Texas, with the exception of Rex Burkhead. And Burkhead is an exception. Once you meet him and talk to him, you kind of know that there aren't going to be a lot of kids like him. So I think Nebraska will reorient its recruiting toward the Rust Belt. Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois. They have good contacts in Illinois. They have great contacts in the state of Ohio. Carl Pelini has more contacts probably in some ways than Bo Pelini. Remember that Carl is sort of the opposite of his brother. He's worked his way all the way up from the very, you know, from the bottom. He's been an athletic director at a high school. He's worked at high schools in Ohio. He's been a GA. So he's sort of, on the opposite end of the spectrum than Bo. As a result, Carl has some pretty good connections in Ohio because of it. Nebraska will also recruit the Southeast. They'll recruit Florida and Louisiana pretty well. Corey Raymond is a secondary coach. He used to play at LSU. He's done a nice job already of making contacts then there. Tim Beck knows people in Florida, and so they're doing a good job of recruiting there. In the state of California, Carl Pelini has good contacts there, and that has borne out to some pretty good players. Taylor Martinez is one of the guys that he found. Damian Stafford, who's already a starter, even though he came to campus about 2 months ago, is another guy that Carl found. And so Carl's going to continue to plumb the state of California for prospects. I don't know that all those guys will pan out because, again, they're not always necessarily going after the first-tier guys out there. But thus far, Carl's done a really good job out there. So I think they're going to reorient from Texas to the Rust Belt. And if I were them, I'd hit Iowa harder. I think Iowa's got some pretty good players, and Nebraska's only picked one guy out of Iowa in the last decade. That's the same number of people they've gotten out of Germany.
Next question. It appeared that Bo and the defense got out-coached last weekend against Fresno. Bo seemed to suggest it was on-field execution. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think that ultimately it's hard to scheme up when you don't have the personnel on the field to do the scheme you want to do. And as long as Alphonso Dennard's out of the game and he's hurt, Nebraska can't run the scheme it wants to run. So I think some of it was execution. I don't think there's any question that there was two pass plays. Fresno missed on the very first play of the game, and then they hit the play, I think, in the fourth quarter. That was a mistake, and that was just poor execution on the part of one player not doing what they were supposed to be doing. In other circumstances, there were a couple of plays where, again, I think the linebacker, Levante, got out of position because he was trying to make a play on the other side of the field, and as a result, they burned him to the other side, et cetera, et cetera. There were some execution issues, but at the same time, I think there's scheme problems, just general. If you don't have great personnel, it's hard to do what you want to do. And Dominican Sue isn't there anymore. And people, I still don't think appreciate how good he was. He was a once in a generation talent, once in a generation player. And then, they had Dejon Gomes and Eric Haig and Prince Mukamara graduate too. So, they don't have the talent that they had 2 years ago or even last year. And so it's harder for a defense to look good if they don't have the personnel to populate the scheme.
Next question. Do Bo and Carl get along?
That's a question I think that would best be suited to answer for the two of them. But, yeah, I think they do. I think that they're very loyal to one another. I think they come from the kind of family where – they might have a fight or a spat, but then they make up. I think they come from a family where family is very important, and they're going to stick by each other. I think they get along really well. How we as Nebraskans define getting along and how maybe the culture of Youngstown, Ohio defines as getting along isn't the same. I think, and that's been an intriguing, I think, contrast. Remember that, some of the coaches that Nebraska have come from a culture like my wife, who grew up in Cleveland. So I'm somewhat familiar with, the Ohio culture because my wife grew up in Cleveland, and I guess I just know the type. And so it's a little bit different than I think most Nebraskans are used to. And so I think, the way that things get solved or conversed about on the sidelines looks a little bit different than the way Tom Osborne did it. But that doesn't mean they're not getting along.
What player do you think can or will have the biggest impact this year?
Well, I'm a football guy, so I'm always going to say the quarterback. So Taylor Martinez will be the person who has the most positive or negative impact on the team at any given time. He's the guy that controls the offense. He's been given a lot more control of the offense. He's the guy that's changing plays quite often now, and he is their biggest playmaker. He is, to paraphrase Reggie Jackson, the straw that stirs Nebraska's drink. He's that guy. So he will always be the person who has the most impact. Number two is Alphonso Dennard, and his impact has his absence has been greatly felt. Before the season, the Ohio State beat writer from the Cleveland Plain Dealer asked me who the three best defensive players were in the conference, and I ranked number one Alphonso Dennard, number two Levante David, number three Jarrett Crick. A lot of Nebraska people would reverse that order, but I'm telling you that Alphonso Dennard is a freak as an athlete, an incredible athlete, and he will be an incredible pro, and he is the most important player to their defense.
What do you think the future of the Big 12 will be?
In the next 2 weeks or so, I think we'll know. I'd like to see it stay together. I predicted in December, when I worked for a different publication, that it would fall apart quickly. I hope I'm wrong. But I suspect that it's going to fall apart, and it's going to be unfortunate that it will. I think that's a lot of cultural and regional history that's going to be thrown in the dustbin for a little bit of money. And that, to me, is too bad. It's just... it's unfortunate because the school that seems most willing to throw it in the dustbin is a school that has so much money already that there isn't anything they could possibly do with more. So it's really unfortunate that it's come to this. I think Nebraska made a wise decision in moving to the Big Ten, in part because some of the principles of the commissioner, Jim Delaney, and the conference as a whole fits Athletic Director Tom Osborne and Chancellor Harvey Perlman. I mean, if you want to get right down to it, I think that the culture and the principles fit. But that doesn't mean I don't think the Big 12 shouldn't survive. I think it's a viable conference. I hope that they're able to figure it out. I just don't think they'll be able to.
Could you speak more about fan entitlement? As a fan, I want to feel like Pelini and the whole program is accountable to me. I don't want the whole program to disappear when there is information that could and should be shared.
Well, the Nebraska football program does not belong to one person or even the members of the team that are currently there. It belongs to the state. And so I've always been a big believer in acknowledging the cultural aspect of that, of understanding that the real owners of the program are the people who have supported it with their finances, with their hearts, with their tears, with their cheers for a half century. Bo Pelini is a steward of the program, right? And the players are stewards, and you hope that they're good stewards. That's really what you can hope for. I understand what people are saying that Pelini has said from time to time, you don't have a right to know what's going on, or you don't have a right to know everything that's happening. And to a certain extent, I understand what he's saying, because I think part of becoming a good steward is understanding like when certain things are better kept among the people whom the problem is with. But I think the pendulum's probably swung too far. And that's just something that is part of the tension. It's part of it. I know a lot of people felt like Bill Callahan didn't acknowledge Nebraska's culture. I'm not sure that he did all the time. But I'm not sure that the current head coach has done a great job either. I think there's been opportunities missed. And hopefully he takes advantage of those over the next several years. I think it's positive that they're doing the Big Red Breakfast again here in Omaha. He didn't go to them last year, and I thought that was unfortunate. I think in some ways the University of Nebraska has ceded the city of Omaha to Creighton on some areas, and I'm not sure why. It's bewildering to me. I have no idea why they do that. I know that's not what Perlman wants, the chancellor, but in some ways it feels like they have. And, the basketball coach doesn't want to play a basketball game at the Quest Center, which is bewildering to me. I have no idea why. No clue. Because Creighton doesn't own the arena. It's not Creighton's arena. Nebraska only wants to play a couple of baseball games up here. Bewildering to me. I have no idea why. You know, I think that Nebraska would be much wiser to open itself up to the entire state and walk in like the biggest school in the state, which it is, play UNO and Creighton and everything, now that UNO is moving to Division I. And if Nebraska is unwilling, I hope that a state senator steps up and actually makes it a law and forces it to happen. I'm serious. I'm not sure what Nebraska's overall athletic strategy is, protectionism, or I really don't know. It's almost like they want to charge Creighton and UNO sometimes a tariff. I have no idea what it is, but it's a mistake. And I think in the last 15 years, someone grew up in Omaha. Nebraska used to have a much larger impact and image in the city of Omaha than it does now. And Creighton has greatly benefited from Nebraska's acquiescence of that impact.
Okay, we've got time for about one more question. Could you predict the outcome of the Washington game? They haven't predicted Nebraska by 17.
Yeah, that's the Las Vegas line. I'll say Nebraska 27, Washington 20. So we can ask one more question. That's
okay. All right. How important is it for Pelini to control his temper on the sidelines?
I think it's really important in the sense that, let's put it this way. I mean, everybody has different opinions about what good and bad temper looks like. In the Texas A&M game, I thought that he as a head coach lost control. And so I think what happens sometimes is when your head coach loses control, your team doesn't know how to react. It's kind of like when you lose control as a parent and your kids are old enough to know what's going on. Maybe they're 10 or 12 years old and they're like, oh, man, you know, there's like a bomb that's just been dropped in the living room here. And what am I supposed to do with it? I think players are somewhat the same way, and I think you need to be able to use your temper effectively. I'm not going to say that coaches don't have tempers, because they do, but if you utilize them and your id just sort of runs wild, I think it's really ineffective to your team. You steal the emotion from your team. You snatch away their emotional energy. You have to learn how to be stoic in certain circumstances and let the team figure out how to be angry about things without you having to step in and show them how angry you are. And that's just life. And that's what being a good manager is. That's what being a good parent is. You have to learn to sort of hand off those things. And I think at times the team has not always responded very well to challenges within games, because I think they're looking to their coaches to see what they're supposed to do. And I think the team needs more strong leaders. And the coaches need to back down a little bit and allow the players to sort of take the mantle, which I think they've done a much better job of this year so far.
Okay, I would like to thank Sam McEwen for attending our forum today. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Sam McEwen, sports writer for the Omaha World Herald, who specializes in covering the University of Nebraska Cornhusker football program. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, October 20th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Father Timothy Lannan, the newly installed 24th president of Creighton University. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.